10,000 coffins, they lie before you, 10,000 places to go to rest, 10,000 ways to sleep, 10,000 nights so deep, coffins, the coffins for you. Yeah. Hey, folks, this is Rish Outfield. This is the Rish Outcast. Should I apologize for what you just heard? Or should I explain that songwriting is not my forte, that it is hard? And writing is hard. I almost said podcasting is hard. Podcasting's not hard. Jimmy Fallon can do it. This is the second episode presenting 10,000 Coffins, which is a novella that I wrote 4 years ago, somewhere around there. I'd say about 2016. And the last episode, the first presentation, I hadn't read any of the story. I hadn't refamiliarized myself with it. I didn't know where I was going to break it up. I didn't even know how long the book was. I'm going to call it a book rather than a story just because I've got it in front of me. It's 3 hours and 51 minutes long. Oh, that's even longer than I thought. So I decided, not really arbitrarily, but yeah, arbitrarily, I decided that it would be 4 episodes. So this is the second of 4 presenting 10,000 Coffins. And by my math, each one is just going to be a little over an hour. And I think that's great. As far as the story itself goes, that's up to you, whether you think it's great. Yesterday, I sat down and I listened to the first 12 chapters, and I decided to end the first section after chapter 6. Chapter 6, if you remember, ends with Brooklyn List seeing the hand on the monitor. And there's something not right about the hand, and immediately she thinks that's a vampire's hand. I want to talk about that, but let me share with you the next few chapters of the story, and then I will meet you on the other side and continue talking about that. Enjoy.
10,000 Coffins by Rish Outfield. 7. Brooke studied the footage, but except for some inconclusive shadows, saw nothing more than the hand. She called Carl Valencia to join her, and found herself yawning as she waited for him, reviewing the images on the various monitors. She tried to stifle the yawn, dreading the simple fact that when she got tired enough, she'd have to go to sleep. The image of that first body, the Anders woman, her expression of terror, would haunt her, no matter how exhausted she got. And where could she take a nap that was guaranteed to be safe from him? A few minutes later, Carl arrived. First, he looked at her, then at the bank of monitors, which were all paused security images, and then back at Brooke.
"Okay, calm down," he said. "I'm listening."
Brooke thought she was plenty calm under the circumstances. It had been terrifying knowing someone was murdering colonists, but now she stood up straight, as though that would give her words more authority somehow.
"I've got a theory, and I'd appreciate it if you at least considered it before shooting it down."
Carl sniffed.
Absolutely. I'm a terrible shot, as it is. She didn't laugh.
He was down there, Carl,
she said, trying to sound casual, and mostly failing.
Same time as me.
You saw him? Well, who was
it? Nope, he hung back. Only footage on security was this.
She waited until she had his complete attention, then called up the security footage to the time code she had saved it at. She pressed play, and the pale hand reached into frame, came into focus for a split second, flipped off the lights, and disappeared in darkness. Carl Valencia opened his mouth to speak, then said nothing. He just blinked at the video.
Show that again.
She did. Look, this is only a theory, but...
He interrupted her with a look.
That's a vampire's hand.
Brooke's eyes went wide.
What? You think that... Why?
I realize it sounds crazy, but...
No, I feel the same way. But how...
It just doesn't look right. The skin is too pale, the veins... Nobody has veins like that, do they?
He looked at his own hand, as though he were mostly unfamiliar with it.
We have veins in our fingers?
Arteries, yes. But this guy's are visible, almost black.
Vampire, he said.
A declaration. Almost an accusation.
Vampire,
she repeated, in the same tone. 8.
Of course, there were files in the ship's computers about vampires, all of them referring to folklore or entertainment. In this modern age, it seemed nobody actually believed they were real, or ever had existed. Yes, there were fringe elements that insisted the old myths were based on truth, mostly intentionally backward religious sects. But those tended to be the same groups that insisted the world was flat and/or 6,000 years old, despite the advent of space travel and non-Earth colonies. Brooke had saved the image in the main computer, of that pale hand flipping the switch on her in sleep deck. It was some kind of vindication for her, that she wasn't crazy, that she'd actually been in the same room as him. Anton Supov had not made the same cognitive leap as Carl had. He went down to sleep deck by himself, then came back to the other two, tight-lipped as usual. Anton, technically, was in charge of their little trio. Whoever had been awake the longest had seniority. That's how it always worked.
Show me, was all he said.
He'd watched the footage once, shaking his head more in disappointment than fear or anger. Anton was adamant that it was a colonist, an undeniably dangerous and psychotic one, that was either running loose on the lower decks or could control their body functions, like a faker could appear dead or in cryosleep when they actually weren't. He reacted to the word vampire in exactly the way Brooke or Carl would have a day earlier, before all this had started, and before they'd seen his handiwork. And his hand. Anton looked at Brooke long and hard, not speaking. And she finally recognized the fear in his eyes. That humanized him a little, in her mind, and inexplicably made her a little fonder of the man.
Any ideas?
She asked him.
Well,
he said, his eyes shifting to the video monitors.
I suppose we should wake Captain Gustafsson.
Brooke thought that was a great idea.
And what will he do?
Carl wondered.
Well, Anton said, I think he'll investigate, weigh the facts, and come up with an alternate explanation to this vampire talk.
You didn't see that body, Carl said, immediately hostile. Or you wouldn't be calling it...
Anton raised his finger, as though he were a teacher or the captain, instead of just the senior crew member by mere chance.
"I saw plenty of bodies," he said. "One would be too many. And yes, someone is killing these colonists. But unless there's a wolf running loose on the ship, it's a human being."
Carl glanced at Brooke, cocking his head.
"They wouldn't have brought wolves to the New World, would they?"
"Dogs, definitely,"
Anton said before Brooke could answer.
"And I believe dogs and wolves are practically the same species. One was domesticated, and the other was wild."
"I don't think a wolf could open and rewire a pod, Anton,"
Brooke said quietly. And of course, she was right. The pilot rubbed his eyes and nodded, feeling foolish for going down that road.
"Okay, then. So it's certainly a man."
"Why not a woman?"
Carl asked. But he probably already knew the answer.
"All the victims have been slim, attractive females, haven't they?"
Brooke nodded.
"Very likely a man, yeah."
"What I mean is, it is a human being we're dealing with,"
Anton amended.
"Not Vlad the Impaler."
Then he chuckled, darkly.
"Who was also a human being."
Carl and Brooke spent hours going through the whole sleep deck, checking out the identical readings. Dead body after dead body, all but two of them young women, the exceptions being a 10-year-old boy and a 5-year-old girl. This was as many deaths as could naturally be expected in a century of travel.
"What kind of monster would do this to a little kid?"
Carl asked, right before vomiting onto the floor, creating yet another mess to clean up.
"What kind of monster would do this to anyone?"
asked Brooke, averting her eyes from both the spew and the dead body. There were two corpses in a state of decomposition similar to the one she had first smelled, due to the seals being slightly broken. Carl theorized that the gases that built up in the cryopods had popped the seal. But Brooke was sure that no gases would build up unless the airtight seal was popped to begin with, chicken or the egg. They removed the two corrupt bodies, taking them down to the morgue, but left all the rest where they lay. To be honest, the contained bodies were better off where they were, since they wouldn't start to rot unless they were opened up. In the meantime, Brooke had decided to wake the captain. Actually, her first thought was to wake up Brig, her fiancé. She wanted someone who had her back, who would reassure her and tell her things would be all right. Also, a spade, she wanted to see him again. To hold and be held. Just for a little while. But it was the captain's job to deal with emergencies, big or small, and he too might reassure her, pretend to be a father figure, at least for now.
"Anton said he'd approve it," Carl said.
"Should Anton be there when he wakes up?"
Brooke asked Carl, as she held the trash bag for him to dump the soiled paper towels.
"If that's what you're worried about."
It was stupid, really, the thought that she might be accused of overstepping her bounds, of paranoid old-time superstition, but she couldn't help how she felt.
No, I'll do it. I'll wake him and explain everything to him."
She sealed the bag, still smelling that sharp odor of vomit.
"It might be smart not to use the V-word until he's up and had his coffee," Carl warned, no smile on his face.
"Yeah, thanks."
Carl remembered something.
"You know, about that, I had an idea."
"Me too," she said.
"You go first."
"Reprogram the ship's computer to alert everybody any time two cryopods report the exact same readings. Stop this from happening again."
Carl shrugged. Well, that's presuming he switches the chips before he opens up one of the... As if she had willed it into being, an alarm began to blare. Carl checked the nearest screen. Impact on cargo deck 2.
Impact?
She repeated, immediately thinking of an asteroid or space debris. Looks like a shelf or storage rack fell down. I'll check it out and then help you thaw the captain.
Don't say thaw,
she said.
And let Anton check out your impact.
Carl huffed. Anton will tell me it's my job. And he'll be right, of course.
But he'll say it in a pissy way.
Yes, he will. And Carl hurried away. Nine. She watched him go. Carl was a goofy-looking man, with no one except his big sister on the trip. He joked that, when they arrived at Outpost 3, she'd then be his little sister. Which wasn't really a joke, just funny. But Brooke felt a bit like his little sister herself, even though she was a year older. She felt affection for Carl, and Anton to a lesser extent, but was convinced that it was only natural to feel a familial bond with everyone you walked around a sleeper ship with. It meant something to know they were the only three conscious people for light years, except on those rare days when there were four people awake, as the end of one of their wake shifts came and the replacement was roused and briefed. But there were already four people awake on the ship right now, she reminded herself, and entered the crew sleep deck, where 25 pods, a little nicer, a little bigger, sat in near silence, their inhabitants under so deeply, there were no dreams. Brooke went by Brig Lefevre's first, passing a moment watching him beneath the plexiglass. He was 26, with olive skin, a high forehead, and premature age lines around his kind eyes. She had visited the crew sleep deck a few times in the past months, usually after a particularly touching, or rousing, message from Brig's wake shift. She had been tempted, on more than one occasion, to wake him up, just for a day or so, and put him under again afterward, as though nothing had happened. But the rules forbade any spurious waking, as the regulations guide called it, and the penalty was an extra month to the wake shift, which actually meant an extra month apart they'd be able to spend together when they got planetside. And everyone on the ship was alerted if anything happened to the crew's sleep pods, so there was no way of keeping it a secret. Still, she was tempted once again, looking at him lying there, so close and yet... The captain had the sleep pod closest to the door, by design. He woke up for a month every travel year, spending time, usually exercising, with each trio of crew members and catching up on what little had changed in 13 months. Captain Gustafsson was a classically handsome man with a square jaw and piercing blue eyes, an aquiline nose and broad shoulders. But he had a bit of a paunch. And Brooke theorized that the reason he played so hard in the exercise section was because he had a genetic propensity for plumpness. She'd seen a photo of him from when he'd first accepted the assignment to the Dawn Breaks, and he was kilos heavier then, almost portly. He was a people person, and literally every member of the crew she had served a wake shift with admired and/or loved him. He'd know what to do. She stepped away from her fiancé and passed the other pods, including that of Shara Numparo, who would be replacing Brooke in about 11 months. Boy, would she have an exciting post-snooze briefing. Captain Benjamin Gustafsson lay in the big pod by the elevator, his old-fashioned sailor's hat sat onto the biomonitor beside him. Even now, he looked like an all-American dad, taking a well-deserved nap on a lazy Sunday afternoon. "Hey, Cap," Brooke said, and turned up his monitor. She reached for the controls, but stopped herself. She went to the wall panel and called Anton.
Yes,
his voice replied, some kind of Caribbean island music in the background. The pilot was nothing if unpredictable.
Are you coming down?
Down? To help Carl? He asked me, but I was busy. There's a quasar just out of eyeshot, and I realized that if we focus the secondary...
Is Carl all right? What happened down there?
Where?
She calmed herself, not yelling in the slightest. The cargo deck.
Ah,
said Anton.
He said two restraint ties snapped down in cargo, too. Suitcases scattered all about.
Two snapped? Is that normal?
I don't know what's normal, Miss List. We are going where no man has gone before.
She didn't recognize the reference.
What is that supposed to mean?
It's from a song or something. I don't know.
Brooke gritted her teeth, then forced them to relax.
Well, are you going to come down here and wake the captain?
Isn't that what you're doing? What's the deceit?
Yes, but...
It bothered her to say it.
Technically, you're in charge.
Technically?
Anton repeated and chuckled.
All right, I'll be down there in 2 minutes. We'll wake him together.
Thanks, Anton.
Miss List, you thanked me by reminding me I'm in charge,
he said. She flipped off the intercom switch a little harder than was strictly necessary. Ten. The two of them stood above the captain's sleeping form. He had that slack-jawed expression of someone in hibernation, almost like a newborn or a fetus. When you were under, you were under. The ship could do a barrel roll, and no one in the cryopods would even blink. If Brooke hit the captain's pod with a sledgehammer, he might blink, frown, and then return to that dreamless sleep that was not much different from death, technically. Except death looked different. Death was obvious. Anton turned from the pod and squinted at her.
You really want to wake him up yourself, don't you?
No,
Brooke lied.
I just would rather talk to him first, before...
Before?
Anton wanted to know.
I don't know, before you tell him how crazy I am.
Anton seemed genuinely taken aback by that statement.
Crazy? Miss List, I don't think you're anything of the sort. You found a dead body, then like 2,000 more. If I didn't make you a little high-strung and paranoid, then it's the universe that's crazy.
Oh,
she said, sighing in relief.
Well, I guess I thought, since you scoffed at the vampire idea...
Well, that part is hard to get on board with. But in point of fact, I saw those dead bodies too. That makes the whole thing a wee bit easier to swallow.
He pursed his lips.
So to speak...
Brooke was grateful to hear it. She took a step back and let Anton fiddle with the computer, then begin the reviving process. Are you sure? Y or N? Came onto the monitor, and Anton hit the Y. There was a humming sound in the cryopod as the temperature started to increase, and Captain Gustafsson got his saline and wake-up cocktail. They could open the pod right now if they wanted to, but it was usually better to let the air inside gradually warm up and recirculate, anything to make the waking process less uncomfortable for the sleeping. Already, the captain's vital signs were starting to change, the heartbeat increasing, the brain activity rising, body temperature readjusting. It would be a while before he was up and running, unless it was an emergency,
and his body would get a jolt of stimulants to bring the sleeper completely awake, the medical equivalent of a splash of cold water. So Anton walked over to the other sleeping crewman, where his husband Yuri was lying. Yuri had been the pilot when the ship first left Earth, and Brooke had spoken to him only a couple of times, before it was time for her and the majority of the crew to start their hibernations. She left the two of them their privacy, watching the captain slowly show signs of life once again.
"We're all a little crazy, you know,"
Anton said from where he was inspecting Yuri's pod.
"To jet off like this, into the great unknown?"
He said it as though it were an actual place, like Grand Cayman Islands or Great Barrier Reef.
"I don't know," Brooke said. "It seems crazier to stay behind, with Earth in the shape it's getting."
Anton scoffed.
"Times are always hard, wherever you go. You think Outpost 3 will be a walk in the park? Even Gorky Park?"
"I don't know. I've never been to
Gorky." "Never mind that. I'm just saying there are challenges everywhere and every when. What we're doing is not unlike cowboys settling on the frontier or Europeans sailing for the New World. Except it literally is a new world."
He found that amusing, much more than Brooke did. It was weird to see Anton so excited and chatty. She'd honestly chalked him up to being a misanthrope that was perfectly content not seeing or speaking to anyone for days on end. It was funny what stress, difficulties, and danger did to people. There was a beep on the captain's biomonitor, alerting them that the injection was complete. Now all they had to do was wait. Anton Supov muttered something, something Brooke didn't get.
"Excuse me?"
she asked, giving him her complete attention.
"I said it's curious Carl isn't back yet," Anton repeated,
looking at the main computer to check their course. Unchanged. That was true. Brooke wasn't worried exactly, but she hoped he wasn't in over his head down there.
"Should we call him?"
"If you like. Maybe there was a great deal to clean up. If rice or beans or Legos or what have you spilled down there, could be a while."
"What are Legos?"
Brooke asked, imagining something like artichoke hearts.
"Nothing. A kind of a joke."
Anton pressed two buttons on the console above the computer.
"Mr. Valencia, everything all right down there?"
Carl didn't answer. Anton pressed another button on the console. There was a beep, one that would be heard all over the ship.
"Technician Valencia, please report to crew deck. MedTech List is awfully fond of you."
Brooke grimaced.
"Why me?"
"Because it's true. Personally, I could take him or leave him."
But he was smiling when he said it. There was no response from Carl. Brooke immediately felt nervous. Or maybe she was already there. She noticed her hands were squeezed into tight fists and forced them to relax.
"Should we go down and check on him?"
Anton smirked, like he remembered an old joke. She hated it when he made that face.
"Are you asking my opinion or for an order?"
She tried to look self-effacing.
"Well, technically..."
"Yes, right. Okay, well, if I technically have seniority, then I will finish waking up Captain Gustafsson, and you go help Carl clean up downstairs."
Brooke wanted to argue, but she had made her bed.
"Yes, sir,"
she said. But she hesitated before starting to move. He squared his shoulders, like a real military man, which he was not.
"You have your orders, MedTech."
She gave him a nod.
"Anton, let me explain it to the captain, okay?"
"I wouldn't dream of telling him the situation when he first comes out, Ms. List.
You remember how that feels. I'll brew some coffee.
That wasn't unlike what Carl had said. She thanked Anton and headed for the elevator, eager to have someone in charge actually be in charge again. The cargo bay was the only section of the ship as large as sleep deck. It held supplies for the colony, the personal effects of all the colonists, and one corner held cryopods with animals in it. Everyone on board, with the rare exception of those who would be making the return journey to Earth, there were always one or two, had pared down their belongings to the barest essentials and brought them on the dawn breaks. Brooke herself had two boxes in here somewhere, probably destined to be undisturbed for nearly a century before they arrived. Frankly, no one ever went down here. It was dark, silent, and nothing in there was usable during the voyage. It wasn't hard to determine which section Carl was in, since a flashing red light could be seen all the way from the elevator. Several crates and boxes were loose from the shelves, neatly stacked on the floor next to where they'd fallen. Two straps hung limply at the bottom of the shelf, their loose ends ragged. Either they'd stretched and broken, or they'd been cut. Carl Valencia was nowhere to be seen, though. In three of the four directions, seemingly endless racks and shelves disappeared into semi-darkness, like the world's biggest library in the middle of a power outage. She was considering going to a panel and radioing for Carl when she heard movement an aisle or two over. "Carl?" she called, and sure enough, there was a slight echo down here. Libraries didn't echo, though tombs sure did.
"It's Brooke. Though, who else would it be?"
Who indeed? Carl didn't answer. She walked down the row to the aisle and saw Carl halfway down, sitting in a chair at the inventory desk. The computer was too dim to view from her position, but he was looking down at something. Reading?
"Something interesting?"
she asked, and winced at the irritating, not to mention creepy, echoing of her voice. She heard another sound from two or three rows of shelves away. No one was there that she could see.
"Carl, are we alone down here?"
she asked. He had not answered or turned her way, still intent on whatever he was watching. She approached him.
"What are you looking at?"
she asked. Then, before he could answer,
"I spoke to Anton. He says he's going to wake Captain Gustafsson. It doesn't really matter who does it, of course, but..."
She stopped. The way Carl was slumped in the chair wasn't right. He was not looking down at anything. Brooke instinctively knew he was dead before she reached the body, before she saw how he had been propped up in the chair, how the entire front of his shirt was black with blood. His throat had been torn out.
"Carl?"
was all she could manage. Brooke was a medical technician, so she knew a dead body when she saw one, but still, she felt she had to make sure. She reached for Carl's carotid artery, changed her mind, and took his wrist instead. His skin felt cool to the touch. Of course, there was no pulse.
"Do you think he'll be all right?"
a voice said from behind her. She whirled, but there was no one there. Just rack after rack of supplies and personal effects, and beyond those, darkness that hit racks of supplies and personal effects. That sensation of being watched was back, only this time her observer wasn't keeping quiet.
"Maybe you'd better check his heartbeat again,"
the voice said. It was obviously male, of indeterminate age, though adult, and had an English accent, like people in old movies. There was dark humor in it. Brooke didn't answer. She wasn't sure she could. Now the voice came from behind a loaded shelf, not quite far enough away.
A friend of yours?
She squinted in that direction, but could see no one.
A lover?
The voice was soft, almost casual. There came a chuckle.
No, not quite a lover. I'd smell that on you.
Brooklyn List had three options. She could run away. She could step toward the voice, try to see his face. Or she could stand where she was, scared and stupid. It appeared that was what she was going to do. It was so quiet in here. So empty. But not empty enough. She gritted her teeth, pushing her fear down her throat as far as she could.
What do you want?
Oh, I had what I wanted, the voice said.
He had an exotic history book accent, something from Europe or a traveler.
A place to sleep and food when I got hungry.
Brooklyn made a break for it, running hard and fast toward the elevator she had arrived in.
Your name is Brooklyn, no?
The man said through the speaker.
And the slouching gentleman was Carlos?
Carl,
she whispered.
Ah, a doctor, a pilot, and a mechanic, am I correct? Each conscious shift.
Right.
And you, Brooklyn, can you fly the ship?
Brooke didn't know whether she should lie or tell the truth. If she said she couldn't fly the ship, would that keep Anton safe? Or would that mean she was the expendable one in the killer's eyes? If she told the truth that she could fly it, but not as well, would that make Anton a target? So she didn't answer.
A simple question,
he said, something playful in his tone.
We need a pilot, she said, or we'll all be dead. You included.
Hence my inquiry.
She ignored the question. Brooke began to walk, slowly and quietly, toward the next elevator bank. The killer's voice seemed to follow her, emitting from each speaker box along the wall. She craned her head back the way she came, to see if he might actually be following her. But she seemed to be alone, from what little she could see of the cargo bay.
Why are you doing this?
Oh, you'll have to be more specific, dear. I was trying to go about my business, operating beneath the radar, as they used to say. But you seem to have bollocked that up.
I didn't do anything. I found one of your bodies and started putting the pieces together.
Be that as it may, I was perfectly content to coexist with you people. Until now.
Coexist, she repeated. Prey on us, you mean?
I never preyed on any of you ship employees. I recognized that you are vital in getting us to our destination.
But not anymore,
she said quietly. It was only barely a question.
You're not entirely my type, dear. Too bony when it comes down to...
I've seen your type, maniac. A lot of them.
But I'm willing to make an exception.
He finished.
I'm flattered,
she said. But she heard a bell through the speaker as the other elevator reached its destination, and the doors opened. She looked around for something she could use as a weapon, and pressed the elevator recall button. There were fire extinguishers every 100 meters, so she opened up the plexiglass case and took one out. She still hadn't seen her tormentor, but the nice thing about being on board a sleeper ship was, chances were, anybody she didn't know was the guy. The familiar beep of the elevator came, and she readied herself. The doors slid open, and no one was inside. She breathed a sigh of relief, But still, she was partly disappointed that she didn't get to whack the man with her makeshift weapon. She stepped into the elevator and pressed the button for the crew sleep deck. She hit the intercom button and typed a 4 for the deck.
Anton? Captain? Are you all right?
There was no response, and immediately she feared the worst.
Are you there?
She asked, practically pleading. There came a click, and Anton's voice came through.
Brooklyn, what's wrong? He was down here. Carl is dead.
Voice boy,
Anton breathed.
What happened?
Who? Zocking.
Another groggy voice asked.
I'll be right there,
she said instead. In the crew's sleep deck, the somewhat pungent smell of his yawning captain filling his nostrils, Anton Supov stood by the intercom, his jaw clenched. He had heard Brooke clearly, but still fought the urge to ask her to repeat herself. Instead, he changed tack.
Did you see the...
He was not going to say vampire.
The killer. Might he still be down there with you?
Brooke interrupted him.
Lock the doors, she ordered. Don't let anybody other than me up there.
Anton's lips thinned at that, but he said,
Right,
and heard MedTech List break the radio connection. He accessed the level computer and security sealed all the doors on that floor of the ship. He had already locked the doors to the main control room behind him when he left. Any of the crew could still access it with an iris scan, but it was standard procedure to keep that section of the ship secured, just in case. In case of something like this.
Pilot Supov,
the captain mumbled behind him. He was sitting up in his cryo bed, rubbing his face with tingling hands. They'd all been there, though the captain got it the most, due to his self-inflicted, preposterous sleeping-waking schedule.
What's going on? Aren't you supposed to be sleeping?
Anton had been on his wake shift, along with Carl and Jiang, Brooke's predecessor, when Captain Gustafsson had been put into cryosleep, which meant that on his next scheduled waking, none of the faces should have been the same.
Sir,
Anton began, still not sure how to proceed, especially since Brooke had wanted to be the one to explain it all. The older man struggled to focus on him, aware that something must have gone terribly wrong.
What?
He asked, that one word fraught with both authority and dread.
We've had some problems, sir. MedTech List we decided to wake you early.
Problems? What sort of problems?
Anton took a moment before answering.
Deaths, sir, of colonists. And now, well, it would seem Mechanic Valencia.
Oh no,
sighed Gustafsson.
Something in the oxygen. Radiation.
No, sir, none of those things. MedTech List wanted to be the one to tell you. She is on her way.
That was MedTech List on the intercom. Cured as a bug, that one. Though skinny, like one of those stick bugs. You ever see one of those? You think it's a branch with leaves and everything, but...
Anton ignored the captain's statements. Wakers always said things they didn't quite mean when they came out of cryo, as the neurons started firing, seemingly at random, while they came out of hibernation. Anton himself had gone on for a moment about the disappearance of Princess Anastasia when he'd been awakened last. MedTech Jiang had played it back for him, thinking, mistakenly, Anton would find it hilarious. After a few minutes, the waker would be back to normal, albeit with extremely sore muscles, and embarrassed about their inane ramblings.
"I'm going to get you a cup of water," Anton said, and went over to the dispenser, grabbing a cup.
No one had used this water tap in weeks, so it took a while to get any water out. But he brought it over and handed it to the captain, making sure the man actually held it before releasing the cup.
Better safe than sorry, experience had taught him.
How are you feeling, Captain?
Feel okay,
Gustafsson said. Then asked,
Is it my imagination, or have I gotten fatter?
Again, Anton did not answer. He headed back to the main computer and pulled up the security footage for the cargo level. He had to toggle through several cameras before he saw the section that was lit up. In one angle, Carl Valencia could clearly be seen. He did not appear to be sleeping. There came a beep at the security panel as the elevator reached crew's sleep deck. Brooke could only stand there, stuck in place, waiting for the door to be unlocked, and beeped again, longer this time. She could bypass the lock if she had to, but it would take a minute or so. Anton crossed the room again, opening a connection to the elevator.
Who is it?
Anton, it's me,
she said through the intercom.
Has anyone else been up here?
Anton knew what she was talking about.
No, just you.
How is the captain?
Heavy set, Gustafsson called.
Anton accessed the security menu and quickly unlocked the elevator door. But just that one, leaving the others all tightly secured. Again, better safe than sorry. XIII. Brooke stepped into the room, looking pale, her eyes red-rimmed, her neck and arms wet with perspiration. She gave Anton a nod and let the doors close behind her.
Lock it,
she said, and walked past him to where the captain was sitting. To Gustafsson's surprise, she threw her arms around him, burying her head in the big man's chest.
Well, that's the kind of welcome a guy likes to get, chuckled the captain, patting her gently on the back. My own kids wouldn't be this pleased to see me.
Bad things are happening,
she said into his shirt. She was aware she sounded like a little girl right now, but it was nice to have somebody here whose job it was to make everything better. Not that that was technically in his job description, but it was implied.
So I understand. Here, help me up,
he said, and she did, though what a 100-kilo girl could do to aid a 200-plus-kilo man, she didn't know. He stumbled slowly to the chairs that Anton had dragged in front of the computer monitor, then changed his mind and headed for the bathroom. Brooke understood all too well, having had her own waking sickness a few weeks earlier. At least the captain had kept his dignity. She recalled with a shudder that she had once inexplicably started singing a song from an old Disney cartoon, embarrassing herself and the decidedly non-musical med tech in front of her. She glanced over at Anton.
Did you lock it?
He sniffed at her micromanagement.
Yes, sir, I did.
On the monitor in front of him, the dead body of her friend Carl was still sitting, hunched in that chair like he was taking the world's most uncomfortable nap. The blood covering his chest looked black from that angle, as though his whole upper torso was missing. Instead, she spent a moment updating the captain, who, upon emerging from the bathroom, looked tempted to go right back in there, or go back into cryosleep. Understandable, all things considered.
There are animals on board, he suggested. Maybe one of those got loose and...
Brooke cut him off.
No, it was a man. I saw him. Spoke with him.
You spoke with him? Who is it?
Anton asked, handing his captain a cup of fresh coffee, the first of many.
I didn't recognize him, she said.
She considered describing the stranger, then glanced over at the monitor again.
But if you pull up the footage of the elevator I took down to cargo, he wrote it up somewhere.
When?
Just before I came up here, he...
She ran a hand through her hair, grimaced, then wiped it on her pant leg.
I guess he wanted to taunt me.
Gustafsson looked around the crew's sleep deck.
None of our men, right? One of the colonists?
I don't think so. We spent a day checking every single pod on sleep deck. None were empty.
Then what then? I can't imagine a stowaway.
My theory is he's exactly that,
Brooke said. Well, that wasn't exactly her theory, but it would do in a pinch.
But that's crazy,
said Benji Gustafsson, shaking his head and spilling a bit of coffee in the process.
How old a man was he?
I didn't get a good look at him,
Brooke said, wishing Anton would get to work and show them what the killer looked like. But then it occurred to her she could do it. It wasn't a pilot's job to call up security footage any more than it was a medtech's. She pressed a few buttons, then dialed in on the angle of elevator 2, which showed the empty compartment, its lights automatically dimmed.
But anybody, even a kid like you two, the captain continued, would die of old age before we got anywhere. Surely a stowaway would know that, even if they thought they might manage to somehow.
Anton interrupted.
Tell him, Miss List.
She swallowed. The captain set down his coffee cup.
Tell me what?
He steeled himself for even more bad news. Brooke exhaled deeply before answering.
I think that we're dealing with some kind of vampire.
What?
The older man barked. He didn't look amused or shocked, more like outraged at the very idea. Brooke put up her hands, eager to be heard out.
Look, he drinks blood. That much is verified. And, well, the one glimpse we got of him looked pale. Wrong. And he said to me, after I found Carl...
She trailed off, feeling self-conscious around Captain Gustafsson, who was glaring at her like this might well have been a nasty prank they were pulling.
"Don't dismiss us yet, sir," Anton said, surprising her.
Perhaps he surprised himself.
"I would have said vampires were ancient superstition a week ago. But I am now considering everything, every possibility."
The captain looked from one to the other, skeptical.
"Okay, here we go,"
Brooke said, having rewound the footage on the second elevator to the point where the lights first went from dim to brightened. A man stepped in, calm and deliberate. He wore a gray tunic, like Anton did, except his was stained brown or black around the neck and chest. The man had sharp features, dark hair and eyebrows, long, pale fingers, and moved like a ballet dancer. He seemed to float rather than walk, as though the ship's gravity conductor was on the fritz. He casually pressed the intercom button so he could jeer at Brooke, but the audio playback was currently muted. There was a visible dark vein going down the man's smooth neck.
"I don't recognize him," Gustafsson said.
He had personally interacted with everyone aboard the ship, standing and shaking hands with each and every colonist as they arrived, greeting them, complimented the young parents on the handsomeness of their children, marveled at how brave the boys and girls were for embarking on this journey, winking at the single young women, who he'd seem like a grandfather to when next they saw him.
"Stowaway," Anton said again.
But stowed away where?
Brooke had to say it.
I think if we were to go through all of the cargo containers down there, we'd find a coffin. His coffin, like in the stories.
The captain looked at her and blinked. He had been rendered speechless. It broke her heart a little to see him look at her that way. Daddy issues, apparently. On the monitor, the stranger smirked, said something else, and pressed the floor 3 button. He waited for the doors to open, then turned. His eyes could be seen for just a moment. The irises were red, not a human color.
Oh my, the captain breathed.
Mies List,
Anton said softly, rewinding the footage so it paused on those startling, alien eyes.
I think I was wrong in doubting you.
That made her feel a little better.
I doubted me myself,
she mumbled. The captain stared at the screen, aghast.
So this thing has been aboard the Dawn Breaks for all these years, sleeping like we do, but waking up and coming after us whenever he gets hungry.
He feeds on young female colonists, mostly,
Brooke told him, making him wince.
It looks like he made several return visits to each one, until they finally expired.
How many?
20-something, so far.
And Carl Valencia, today.
Brooke said,
That's right.
It took 2 tries. Carl's death didn't seem real. It was like a dream she'd had. Maybe it was shock. Captain Gustafsson shook his head, taking it all in. Anton added,
And he's smart enough that we hadn't noticed it before now.
The older man gritted his teeth.
Well, we've noticed it now, and it's gonna stop.
He turned to Anton, authority in his voice.
Pilot Supov, let's implement heightened security across the whole ship. Only the 3 of us allowed in restricted areas.
He seems to know his way around the systems,
Brooke said.
At least enough to move where he likes.
A nod.
All right. Maximum security, then. Employee access codes to use the elevators, to enter sleep deck, cargo level, heck, even to get in the bathrooms.
Anton glanced back to the computer monitor again, at that reptilian glare.
Might I suggest the retinal scans, rather than just the code?
Good idea. With peepers like that, he won't be opening any locked doors.
Brooke didn't know what peepers were, but she got the gist of it.
What we need to do is figure out where he is, lock that area down, and then...
What? Anton asked.
Let him rot in there?
She suggested.
No. Our whole mission is compromised, as long as that thing is alive.
Captain Gustafsson puffed up his broad chest.
Let's isolate him, then figure out a way to terminate him.
Of course, the captain had that kind of authority on his ship, with no reason to answer to anyone back on Earth, or feasible way to do so. But no one planning this trip had foreseen any need for judicial power, at least nothing so extreme. Brooke must have looked dubious. So the older man said,
You disagree? We can do an all those in favor say aye if you like.
That man killed 26 people,
Anton said.
Consider me an aye.
27,
Brooke said, thinking of poor Carl Valencia.
Aye for me too.
The captain nodded, looked back toward the monitor. Then began to think.
10,000 coffins open up for you. 10,000 hiding places, what should you do?
Okay, folks, that's where we are going to end for today. And if you'll give me just 1 second, I'm going to find out where that is. Let's find out where that takes us. I know where it takes us. I just listened to it. I had to figure out where we were in the story so that I would know what to talk about and what not to talk about. And I did actually a pretty smart thing. I decided where I was going to stop and then immediately sat down and started doing this episode so that it would, A, be fresh in my mind, and then, two, when I'm done with this, I can continue listening. And when I drive home from the cabin this afternoon, I can do the next episode, knowing where that stops. But right now, I'm just in the cabin by myself with a blanket around me. This is probably the second to last time I'll ever get to come up. Not ever. Oof, that's fatalistic, isn't it? This year, the second to last time I'll be up here. Who knows? I may not be able to make it up here again, in which case I will regret all the stuff that I'm leaving. But it is what it is. So right now, we have four characters again. At the end of last episode, we had four characters. One of them was a mystery character. One of them was the Hand. But we lost Carl in this episode, and we gained the skipper. We gained Captain, is it Gustafsson? I think when I was doing the audiobook for this, I had two different names for the captain. And I thought, oh, shoot, which is it? And I decided I liked Gustafsson more. It's just a strange, it's a memorable name. I've never met anybody named Gustafsson. Have you?
Oh, hell no!
But he is the new fourth character. And honestly, if I had recorded this episode yesterday, I would have guessed that the captain doesn't show up until like chapter 19 or 20, toward the very, very end of the book. But I guess these are very, very short chapters. I can't say. So the two things that I wanted to talk about on this episode. The first is I wanted to address the Hand. That's a vampire's hand. So that's the last bit that we heard in the first episode. And this episode continues from there. But I did want to address that. Too many times when I see a horror movie, characters take forever to come to the conclusion that we are dealing with a ghost. We are dealing with a werewolf. We are dealing with possession. We are dealing with a vampire. There is a huge back and forth, an argument of how ridiculous that is and ooh kind of thing. But there are times when that's acceptable. That kind of pushback, that kind of disbelief is acceptable. But a lot of times in these movies, you're like, well, dude, you just saw somebody, you know, pass through a wall. You just saw a wolf the size of a German shepherd. You know what I mean? Or you just saw technology that is decades past what we have. Why would you continue to say, well, that's ridiculous. This can't be an alien we're dealing with. And so when Brooklyn mentions that it's a vampire, she thinks it's a vampire, that's a vampire's hand, there's some pushback from Anton. But Carl is almost immediate in agreeing with her. Yeah. Somehow they know that's a vampire's hand. And that's something that I did intentionally. That's something that I wanted to try in a story like this. Instead of having chapter after chapter of ridiculous, I'm not listening to any more of this vampire talk. And Anton maintains the doubt. a hell of a lot longer than Carl does. And I find that that makes him less likable. Carl is the more likable character. Carl is the character that's the most like me. And he has a crush on Brooklyn. And immediately he agrees with her that this is a vampire. And I think whatever she says, he is more willing to just go along with. Whereas Anton feels threatened by her. Anton doesn't like to be told what to do when technically he should be in charge, even though they all really have the same rank. Let's just talk about Anton for a minute. So in the last episode, I know because I just edited it today, I talked about the Russian aspect to it. And I'm pretty critical when it comes to my accents. When I hear myself say answer when I'm doing a British accent, I'm just like, oh, couldn't you have done that again and just said answer? The Brits pronounce the A a little differently than we do. And to say, hear you say answer, and it sounds like you're plugging your nose. I'm ashamed of that kind of thing. But boy, there are a lot of balls to juggle when I'm doing accents and acting and reading Abby's book and trying to maintain the same character voices, which I have established in earlier books. Those are a lot of balls to keep in the air. And if I say answer, you'll just have to forgive me. I'm doing the best I can, and it's pretty darn good most of the time. I thought Anton's accent was pretty consistent. And there were a couple of times when he sounded like Chekhov on Star Trek. And it made me wonder, is he inspired by Chekhov? If I hadn't been a Star Trek fan, would there be a Russian character in here? And isn't Anton the first name of Anton Chekhov, the writer? I'm not sure. I did have a friend, a coworker from Russia, who taught me some phrases. She taught me how to say Dobrajien. And I remember when I would try and speak Russian, she would say, you sound like Mexican speaking Russian. And I thought that that was very, very funny, because instead of an American sounding Russian, she said I was a Mexican sounding Russian. And I remember when I took Italian in college, they said, yeah, your Italian sounds like Spanish. And that's a problem for me, but I don't give a shit.
Jeez.
You know, to me, it's just like, hey, I'm an American. None of us speak anything. So the fact that I speak fluent Spanish and I'm trying to learn Italian, that's already so far out of my comfort zone, guys, that if I sound like the Mexican ambassador to Italy speaking Italian, I'm fine with that. And same thing with the Russian. There is something that I do with my mouth and my brain when I'm trying to speak a foreign language. And the default is Spanish. I'm not sure how much I've gone into my ancestry. I'm sure I've told you that my grandmother was a Mexican citizen. She came to America with my mother when my mother was 12. They had sent my mom to school in Arizona when she was 10, and then she came back, and then they sent her again, I think, when she was 11 or so. And so her English was very good. My mom speaks fluent English with an American accent, and you'd never, ever know that she wasn't born here. But my grandmother always struggled with English, and that was how you communicated with her. And there was a big stretch of time when I couldn't really communicate with my grandmother. And then I became fluent in Spanish. Spanish was my first language when I was a child, because my mother worked full time and left me with my grandmother when I was, you know, a year old or something like that. So I spoke both English and Spanish. But as soon as we moved away from California and away from my grandmother, I lost it all. As I have now. My Spanish is terrible now, and I'm embarrassed by that. I'm sad by that, because I really like the language, and I like to be able to communicate, and It sucks to get old. It sucks to get weaker. It sucks to see white in your beard and at your temples. And losing my Spanish is a lot like that. Anyhow, I was talking about Anton Supov. I think... Oh, okay, let's talk about the future just for a second. But let me finish my thought. I think that he resents the native English speakers. He resents the Americans for all having this in common. Even though America is very, very big, not as big as Russia, come on, but it's very, very big, and somebody can be from Chicago, and somebody can be from Florida, and somebody can be from Texas, and somebody can be from California. And they're all Americans, but they have different cultures and different upbringings, that sort of thing. I think Anton sort of resents that. And when this story takes place, is there still a Russia? Is there still an America? Are Carl and the captain and Brooklyn all Americans? Or is it sort of a hemispheric thing by this point back on Earth, which I hint is not in such good shape? In fact, I think there was a line about the last World War, and we know it wasn't World War II. When this story takes place, let's say that this takes place, let's just be optimistic and say that it takes place in 2123. Or if I wrote it in 2017, 2117, will there still be an America then? I'm not sure. Certainly it won't be what it is now, but will the world be what it is now? Let's look at 1917. 100 years ago, the world was so very different. It was so much bigger. People were so much more isolated. Communication, travel, technology, it was all a different world. Now, a lot of the world had banded together for the Great War. And so maybe the world had gotten a little smaller than it had been before we had a world war. And then certainly the giant influx in technology that came because of the Second World War, that, you know, this period between the wars of prosperity, vulgar prosperity, and then depression, and then the war years, and then Reconstruction after the war, and the space race, the Cold War, all of these things increased our technology, changed our way of life so very, very much. And, you know, you look at my lifetime, and I think that the big advancement in my lifetime was the internet. And the internet made the world so much smaller. Two nights ago, I talked to Gino Moretto.
thank you.
We just talked back and forth in real time. And I believe he was 14 hours ahead of me down in New Zealand. And not only 14 hours ahead of me, but he is in springtime, almost summertime, while we have snow on the ground. That boggles my mind. I mean, it boggles my mind that I have a friend that lives on the other side of the world.
Oh, hell no.
It just, well, if you know me at all, it boggles my mind that I have a friend. Again, I didn't create a world that's all detailed, and I know what happened on Earth, and I know what happened to America and Russia and all that stuff. This colony that they're going to, is it colony number 3? I can't remember. Who is in charge of that colony? Does it belong to America? Are we colonizing in the way that we did, you know, in the 15th century and beyond? Is there a flag put in the ground in this colony? Just this year, 2023, I wrote a story, I think, that takes place on that colony. Yeah, and it's probably not a story I'll share with you because It's problematic. Everything's problematic. I recognize that. But there are some things that are more problematic than others, and I worry about. I worry about somebody saying, like when I ran the Robert Howard story and somebody saying that I was a fucking white supremacist and, you know, a Southern apologist with a Confederate flag on my wall. And I just, I'm not that. I guess I don't want to write something that gives somebody the impression, oh, this is somebody that hates women, or this is somebody that hates, you know, Muslims or people with Down syndrome or children or fill in the blank. As a writer, if you are a writer, and a lot of the people that listen to this show are, and that is really cool. If you're a writer, you tend to think about other points of view. You tend to try and imagine what it would be like to be a gay black woman with no arms and legs in the 1700s. And it expands your mind a little bit. And maybe it expands your heart a little bit that you can feel empathy for somebody who is not you or who is not like you. I feel like I have a lot of empathy toward other people, but at the same time, there are so many truly reprehensible people, and they live without empathy. They live without having to be flexible, without having to open their minds. And so it is easier to see those people as the enemy, to see those people as not really people. I'm trying, folks, but it's something that takes a whole lifetime. And when I reach the end, I will still have a long ways to go. And maybe you will too. Hell, maybe Marshall Latham will have a long ways to go.
I also like Marshall the best.
Yeah, I like Marshall the best too. Shut up. It's a journey. We progress a little bit at a time, and then we fall. We fail. We lose our temper. We say something in the heat of the moment that maybe we didn't mean, or look, maybe you did mean it. I don't have a Confederate flag on my wall, but sometimes you'll hear somebody talk who does and say, you know, their point of view, and I go, oh, well, you know, when you put it that way, that doesn't seem like an illegitimate point of view. Being a writer helps you do that. And, you know, Brooklyn List, we'll talk in the next episode, let's say, about who she's not based on anybody. I was about to say who she's based on. Again, it's a female protagonist. In this one, she has a medical background. She's not dumb. And a lot of the characters that I write are dumb. Laura Deming is not smart. I love her to death, and I hope that you love her too. But she's not smart. And Brooklyn is. And that's part of what I'm talking about with empathy, with trying to put myself in her shoes. This creature that's on board the Dawn Breaks is, I guess, a representative of the old way of doing things, the old world. You know, if you want to say that the toxic masculinity, you want to say the evil patriarchy or whatever, that's what this vampire is. He preys on young women, and yeah, a couple of children, but there's definitely a sexual aspect to what he does. And that's something that I sometimes struggle with understanding. You know, there's somebody, I almost said a friend, I've brought her up before, but she hates men. She hates them. I'm using the word hate here. And one of her big reasons for it is that she feels like men are predators and women are prey. And it's so hard for me to get my head inside her point of view. But this creature that's there with the colonists is that. And, you know, it wants to get to the colony and start again. I suppose, does it have motivation? Is it instinct? Does it have a sort of less evolved brain that, you know, it's got these wants and it has the power and ability to achieve those wants. It doesn't often have to compromise. It doesn't often have to communicate or feel empathy. Empathy is a big deal for me, at least in this episode, huh? Somebody that doesn't have any empathy, that's not somebody that I want to be around. That's not somebody that I want to know. I could certainly work on aspects of my character that are lacking. But empathy is something that I have worked on, that I have developed. Maybe it's a topic for another day, but it's just there's the little insular community that you grow up in. Or yeah, we're not talking about you, are we? That I grew up in. Then taking a step outside that community and seeing that there are different points of view, different attitudes. So that's a second step. And then the third is appreciating those things and saying, well, that person's not like me, and yet that's a good person. Or, oh, geez, the horror of that person is just like me and they can be a bit of a douche. Does that mean that I am a bit of a douche as well? You know, so there's another thing. I feel like I'm no longer talking about 10,000 coffins. So we'll bring this episode to an end. I hope that you are enjoying the story. I do feel like it's moving a little too quickly. As I said in the last episode, it's too short to be a novel. It probably needs to be twice the length if it were going to be a novel. But it's also way too long to be a story. And there are little aspects, little things that I would like to explore and expand. And every time there is an info dump, maybe I don't do that very elegantly. But me in 2023 listening to it thinks, well, I'd like to know a little bit more about that. I'd like you to expand on that. And yeah, I would like to know Anton's thoughts about us versus them. He's got a husband, and his husband is also Russian. And so my thought is that when the two of them get together, his personality is totally different. And he's able to just be joyous and light. Whereas he's sort of dour in this story. And it's a dour story. So, you know, he belongs in it. Okay. Join me soon for the third section of this story. And I realize that I've gone on too long. And I will try to do better. And I will fail. Thank you for listening. I've been Rich Outfield. Good night.
This is Fake Sean Connery. And you can support me and the boy over at patreon.com. Encourage us to put out more shows by donating $1 an episode. Or more if you've got more money than sense. Which, I suppose, some people have. And that's it for the Rish Outcast, which is produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution No Derivatives license, which means Rish owns it, unless he stole it, and it's free of charge, unless you paid for it, and Rish has been lying all this time. What?
Oh, and thanks to Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com for his music. Now there's a real man.
Thank you. What would you say to not just me, but especially me, but anybody who has written something and they're just like, oh, you know, I wrote this in the middle of the pandemic when people refused to wear masks. Or I wrote this in the middle of the pandemic when the government was saying I had to wear a mask. Damn it, don't do that with the accent. I wrote this in the middle of the pandemic when the government was saying I had to wear a mask.
That's interesting. I coughed and it made the static go away.
Sleep visited him rather late, but it was consoling.
Technically, Dad won the lottery,
Andover said.
He told me he might. Perpetua's impulsive, willing to cut corners ever since she was young. She's made. Excuse me. She's made some very powerful enemies. He told me he might cash the check and then head out to Montana and start a new life. Make a new family. Maybe a daughter who's not a total gash.